Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AA BlueChipSpeakers.org desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. And I have the privilege of introducing our speaker tonight, and I don't know if you've heard Mike's story or not, but one of the things that impresses me most about Mike is how incredibly humble he is and centered in this program. And I know that it probably stems from his work with alcoholics, which is incredible, the amount of work he does with other alcoholics. So this is a very humble and dedicated man to this program, and he also plays a mean guitar. So with that, I give you Mike.
I'm just bringing this up in case some fruit starts to fly. Thank you. Block myself off. Everybody, my name's Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow. This is, I'm even more nervous than I thought. Whew. 5 years ago, when I first started coming into this room, there just really was nothing left. And this room right here was the first room where people looked me in the eye a little bit and shook my hand and asked me how I was doing and remembered my name. And that just meant so much. My sobriety date is December 13th, 2010. My home group is the Monday night Blue Chip Speaker meeting, this meeting right here. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor a few guys, not a whole lot. I was born in 1964. I'm an Atlanta native, and there's not that many of us really running around. My father got an urge when I was 6 years old to be a farmer, and we left Atlanta and moved to Griffin, Georgia, and you know he bought a farm and started working on the farm. And that was kind of a harsh blow. You know, I used to hang out in the kitchen with my mom here in Atlanta and listen to Peter Paul and Mary records and bake cookies. And then I, you know, 7 years old, I'm snatched to this environment where one of the happiest days of my early times there at the farm, I remember, was the day that I learned to shoot the automatic shotgun well enough to hit a milk jug, because that meant that I could walk around in the pastures and not be worried, about possibly being attacked by the bulls, because you had bulls that ran with the cows, and they were pretty scary. So I kind of, fear was kind of with me from the start. My dad had a bad temper, he definitely, if you looked at the symptoms of a rageaholic, he would be there. And so early on, I've been blessed with being fairly athletic, and started playing football kind of as a way to kind of reduce the stress and, to get patted on the back and everything. And the alcoholic mentality was with me early. At the school that I went to from second to sixth grade, you got a report card, and all on the report card, you had five categories, and you got S's or N's from each teacher for each quarter. I went for the entire 5 years, and all I ever got was S's. I got straight S's for 5 years. And I was really pissed off that they didn't give me an S+. I felt like I deserved a little bit more. And that would come back to bite me later. And I also, early, I developed a relationship with God. I would pray every night when I went to bed to please God, don't let Mr. Jackson, the bus driver, don't let Mr. Jackson turn me into the office in the morning. Me and a bunch of my football player buddies, we all had assigned seats right behind the bus driver. And I prayed every night to not go to the office. And it worked usually for about 2 or 3 months. And then we'd go to the office and take our little paddling. And then we'd be free on the bus. And we'd be back in the assigned seats before the bus left the school parking lot. And it just never crossed my mind, maybe you should behave on the bus. That didn't. Never made any sense. I had my first drink at age 14. Was at a party, and somebody had a bunch of those little pony beers. And from the first one I turned up, it would run straight down my throat. I've always just had that ability to open my throat, and bam. And I drank a lot of them that night. And the promises definitely came true for me. I intuitively knew how to handle all these situations, which had me beaten down. I was smaller. I mean, I got taller. My shoulders got bigger. I got smarter. You know, it was just a wonderful thing. And the next morning I woke up, and at the party we're doing something where I was smoking candles, pulling the wicks on the candles through and having some flame going. And I woke up the next morning and I was kind of cut up and bruised and dirty. We'd all been fighting in the shrubs, you know, with a bunch of other football players at the party. And my mouth was all full of this dried wax and everything. I just woke up, oh, God. And my first thought was, God, I got to quit smoking candles. The thought that maybe I shouldn't drink? Nah. And that mentality kind of stayed with me for about the next 30 years, on and off. I discovered alcohol in a lot of forms, pill alcohol. That was very convenient. You could have a large supply with you in your pocket. Nobody could smell it. I was a better football player on pill alcohol. I was meaner and faster. All other sorts, herbal alcohol, but it was all alcohol. It was all chasing that feeling of ease and comfort that I first felt at 14. I fled the dairy farm at 18 and went to the University of Georgia. You know, I was not a farmer. Just not me. And you know, had a lot of fun at the University of Georgia. There was a symptom that came up that now is pretty obvious. I'd always kind of wanted to be a veterinarian. I kind of liked on the farm being able to doctor all the cows and everything, and, you know, diagnose them, give them shots. I delivered a bunch of calves, you know, as we went through. And, you know, I thought that would be a cool thing. I'd read all these books by this author, James Herriot, All Creatures Great and Small, about his experiences as a vet. And I'd also thought about being an airline pilot. I'd been to the airport a few times, and I love watching the planes land and everything. I got to the University of Georgia, and it was just so much fun to be had. And those vet school guys, they were working their butts off. You know, they were studying all the damn time. And the Air Force guys that were doing the pilot thing, they weren't having any fun. You know, they were running around in these little suits and just... So I kind of said, well, you know, maybe I'll just study economics and music and have a good time. I really don't care that much about being a vet. And that was a real important sign. I kind of changed my goal to let me keep doing what I was doing. And I've heard other people doing that. It's not unique. And I had a lot of fun at the University of Georgia. Widespread Panic played a pool party for me, 1986. I played music in Athens. I had a real good time. It just seems like it was so different then than it is now. I remember I took a Spanish class, and it was a 10 o'clock class, Spanish 103, and the teacher liked me. She liked to come hear my band play. And I did a presentation on tequila. And I borrowed a briefcase from a guy. I walked into the classroom with the briefcase with tequila and limes and everything. When it was my time to get up, I got up, opened the briefcase, blasted a shot, spoke for about a minute, blasted another shot, finished up another minute, blasted another shot. So I did three shots in about 2 minutes. And I got an A. You know, I don't know what would happen if somebody did that at UGA now. But got out of UGA and went to work in business. I really was kind of sick of the whole music thing. You ladies probably know the company Vanity Fair, VF Corporation. Made a lot of Victoria's Secret. We made Lee jeans, Wrangler jeans. I tell everybody that I know way too much about bras and panties. Just, you know, more than any man should. I called them, that group, I called them the Nazis making panties. So that was kind of what it was like. They were dead serious about that underwear. And, you know, I did pretty well with that kind of thing. I moved back to Atlanta in 96. Through the 90s, I was starting to have some problems. Back problems from football, other little injuries. Problems getting along with people a little bit. Getting along with wives, that kind of stuff. Yes, plural. Luckily, the job I had, I got to move a lot. I got to move every year, 18 months or so. So we kind of had a perfect geographical thing worked in. I made it back to Atlanta in 96. You know, kind of getting a little bit worse here or there, started back into the music. In 2000, I had my first back surgery. And that didn't go real well. They told me that you're going to be under for 3 hours. You're going to walk that afternoon, and you'll leave in 3 days. And that was in the morning. And I woke up, came out of the surgery, and it was dark. It was already night, and everybody's sobbing and crying around the bed. And they told me that I could not move for 3 days. I ended up being in the hospital for a week and a half, and the surgery was real bad. I had a lot of back trauma from the football, compression fractures. Disc had grown into my spinal cord. It was just a mess. But I kind of continued on, and in 2004, I had an epidural for back pain. Some of you guys have probably had them. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. You know, they take a big needle and they jam it in your back and they flood you with a bunch of chemicals, and that's kind of the, supposedly to help the pain. You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But I liked epidurals because if you worked an epidural right, you could stay in the heavy stuff for 3 or 4 months around it. You know, you just limp in afterwards and tell the doctor you're still hurting, flop around on the table a little bit, just, you know, then you go to the next doctor and do the same thing. That kind of stuff. And one thing I was real big on, if you started giving me a lot of problems about pill alcohol, I would back way off on that and just start drinking more. You know, I'd have beer for breakfast, beer for dinner, you know. And if you started giving me a lot of grief about that, I'd kind of switch back around, you know. So it was kind of a moving target effect. But the last epidural I had in 2004 punctured my spinal cord by mistake. And you sign a piece of paper saying they could kill you. I looked into it. But pain got a little bit worse after that, and I got introduced to even heavier stuff. And I had to go on disability in 2006 for the spinal cord injuries. Had plenty of money, had a big house up in Kennesaw, you know. Wife that loved me and you know, put up with way more than she should. And I should have been set. You know, I had taken care of financially, got a place to live, all this other stuff. And you guys probably know how it comes out. If it had come out well, I wouldn't be up here now. I just kind of did what we do. You know, I'm seeing lots of doctors, just wallowing around in my own misery. There's a story in the big book that's dead on it about the guy that retired, comes out with his carpet slippers, and in 4 years he's dead. In 4 years, I was in Peachford Hospital. And Peachford was not my first time in that kind of place. Went to Ridgeview, South Cobb, Anchor. If you could have a good discussion about the relative merits of the treatment centers in the area, you may have a problem. You know, Ridgeview, they got great food, but you got to walk outside to get it. You know, it's kind of a balancing thing. So in December 2010, I ended up in Peachford. Wasn't my first time in a place like this. And kind of the way it always worked was I'd go into a place like Peachford, you know, to detox, get it out of your system, you know, get clean. And then, you know, you go back to the job, the wife, the house, you know, go back to whatever family members are putting up with you at the time. And you know, you're kind of supposed to be okay, and it just never worked like that with me. It was always between about 30 and 60 days. Whoever was putting up with me at the time would look at me and go, "My God, man, you are worse without it. We know we wanted you to quit, but now that we've seen you without it, you know, we prefer you with it. Just go back and see the doctor, would you?" And that's really kind of how alcoholism showed up in me. All the stuff that I was trying to medicate and run away from and everything, if you took all that away and you didn't give me some kind of real solution, then you really got to see it. And, you know, it was getting worse and worse over time. By the time I got to Peachford, I came into Peachford on December 13th, and I had been at the emergency room at Kennestone the night before. And I would tell you I didn't have a problem at Kennestone or at Peachford. I was at Peachford voluntarily because I had decided the night before about 11 o'clock to get in the ambulance on the left side of my yard instead of getting the cop car on the right side of my yard at 11 o'clock December 12th. And it just never ever crossed my mind that normal, sane, well-adjusted people just aren't faced with that choice. You don't have to decide ambulance or cop car when you're out dressed in camouflage in your front yard. But I would tell you I didn't have a problem, and this is embarrassing. But when I got to the emergency room at Kenistone, they made sure I wasn't going to die right away. You know, they checked out real quick. And then they made me take a bath. Just how bad do you have to be for them to want you to bathe in the emergency room? You know? It was bad. I had two warrants out for my arrest by that time in two different counties. I had four lawyers working for me. I loved lawyers. Just keep writing the checks and, you know, keep moving. I was in some deep, deep trouble. You know, my wife was gone, divorced. Nobody in my family talking to me. And it was pretty bad. The second day I was at Peaceford, I had a big open head wound here on the side of my head that couldn't be stitched, where I'd had a seizure into my computer keyboard from benzo withdrawal. I had a concussion. I had double vision. I had second-degree burns on my hands because I was trying to make blackened chicken several days before I got in, and I ended up making blackened dope fiend instead. I grabbed, you know, burned both my hands. I just, you know, wasn't really paying attention. And the second day I was in Peaceford, you know, people come up to you, "Hey, man, what are you in for? What did you do?" And I looked at this guy, and I said, "Man, I think I got hit by a truck." And I was kind of trying to be funny, you know, laugh a little bit. And he kind of looked me up and down. He said, "Yeah, I think you're right." You know. But you get a lot of good information from folks with no shoelaces, you know. There are intellectuals left and right in that kind of environment. And I was counseled by some of those folks that you can't get arrested if you go to rehab. I was like, okay, that's interesting. And I was talking to my lawyers while I was in there, and they said, "The only chance you have is that you've got to do everything your doctors are telling you to do. You've got to fully follow medical care. And we might be able to help you if you do everything your doctors are telling you to do." So I said, "Okay, sure, that sounds fine." I found a residential rehab to go to. And the doctors also wanted me to sign up for the PHP program at Peaceford. That's typically when they give you your keys and shoelaces back, they tell you to go to PHP. And every place has aftercare like that. I just never was really interested in it before. Just give me my stuff. I'll be fine, you know. So I signed up for that, too. I got out of Peaceford New Year's Eve, and this just tells you how bad it was. Had a little dog, a little pug, and my dad and stepmom and her family had picked up my dog at the house, and they had her. They picked me up at Peaceford and spent the drive out to Conyers, where they live, telling me about how much trouble I was in, trying to beg me, you know, to do a will. That was about all they would say, just please do a will so we don't have to sort through all this mess. They took my dog, and my dog stayed in the family's house there in Conyers. And they put me in the Days Inn on the side of the interstate at the Conyers exit on I-20. You know, my dog got to stay with my family, but I didn't. They just didn't want me around. They didn't want me going through the stuff, stealing, scamming, you know. They came and got me each day for a couple hours to hang out with the family. But, you know, they didn't want me around. So, got done with Christmas. I came to my residential rehab, started up in the PHP. Man, God, I hated that. Yeah, with the rehab, they had schedules from the time you had to get up in the morning till the time you went to bed. You know, what you're supposed to be doing. You know, they wanted me to clean toilets. I'm like, "Look, man, just call this number. She'll come over here and clean the whole place, and I'll pay her," you know. But they wanted me to do it myself, and I just kind of had to. I went to a book study that very first day, and I asked them, you know, I'm just kind of standing there clueless in the thing. And I said, "What book are you guys studying?" And one guy said, "The Big Book." And I just went, "Oh, my God, these freaks can't even call it the Bible. You know, what have I done, Lord? What have I done?" And as soon as I found out about the Big Book, I went trying to find cliff notes for it. Some of you guys probably, I'm like, 164 pages, please, man, I'll lace this tomorrow. You know, just, you know, let me, there are no cliff notes that I was able to find. And it was rough. I was going to PHP. the counseling thing at Peaceford, and they were telling me I had to get honest. You know, get honest, it'll save your life. I'm like, no. The last thing I need to do is get honest. I need to come up with some better scams. You know, because these people, everybody around me kind of knows all the stuff I've been running on, and they're getting tired of me. Honesty was the last thing. And what I started doing was being honest from 4 o'clock to 4:15 every day. And I would say one honest thing from 4 o'clock to 4:15. You know, I kind of built from that. I was very open-minded as far as I would have done anything they told me to do to get out of trouble. And I was very willing to do anything that they told me to do. And I didn't think any of this stuff would work, really. I was just trying to, you know, just to get out of all this trouble. And they told me to get a sponsor. Somebody introduced me to this young guy. He'd been through the rehab. He was half my age, but he knew the guy that ran the place. So I was kind of screwed a little bit there. And he didn't really tell me so much what to do. He just kind of told me what he did. You know, he told me about getting guys' phone numbers and calling them up and reading at meetings, you know, being of service at meetings, setting up chairs, get there a little early, stay there a little late, meet some people, do all this stuff. And I'm like, dude, you know, I'll give you some honesty. I don't care how these guys are doing, man. What about the chick over there with the tats? You know? Can I get her phone number? Yeah, we all love romance and early sobriety. I had a plan there with a girl that was also in PHP with me, and she was at the same rehab, and we were going to run away in the middle of the night and commandeer my bankrupt house in Kennesaw and start anew. You know, it made sense at the time. And I was going to all these 12-step meetings, and you know, I didn't really like that either. There were people, there were guys hugging guys. I kind of thought it was a cult. They're chanting. It just was really weird. But the strange thing was, once out of every 5 or 10 meetings, man, I would hear somebody say something that was just, oh my God, exactly what I had done, you know, or exactly what I had thought. And I didn't think anybody else thought like me, kind of, or had done all the crazy stuff I had done. And it was kind of a good feeling, you know, to start between what my sponsor had me doing and going to these meetings. I was starting to get the idea, you know, that maybe I wasn't a bad, evil person, but that I was very sick, you know, and that I had a fatal disease, and I had one foot in the grave and one foot on a banana peel. And that was about where I was. I started seeing a couple of doctors. I had to be honest with the doctors. I had to tell them I was an addict. I had to tell my family I was an addict. And I couldn't just do that right. I'd be like, I'm an alcoholic, you know, I'm an addict, mom. And everybody that knew me, their response was all the same. They're like, well, no joke, man. You know, we've known it for 30 years. Welcome to our party. I was the only one that was surprised. And the doctors, you know, for the first time, I had to take all these meds the doctors were giving me, you know, legitimate chronic pain and some other stuff. I had to take this stuff exactly as prescribed. I'm like, I'll show you a suggestion, man. That crap that's written on the bottle, flip it around. Do the 6 in the first hour, you know. But, you know, the staff supervised. I had no choice. I had to follow all these directions. And at 30 days, I was just, oh, miserable. I called my sponsor up, and I'm like, man, I am sick and tired of this place. I'm sick and tired of all you grinning, smiling people. You know, this is just driving me nuts. I want to go out and just get wasted right now. And he said, well, if that doesn't prove to you that you're an addict, an alcoholic, I don't know what will. All the trouble you've gotten into, all the stuff you've done, and you just want to go do more, click. Oh, man. And I stayed up that whole night just flopping around on the bed. And I was out early the next morning on the back porch of the rehab, and it was cold, and I was just, you know, in turmoil, just miserable. And 6:30 or 7 in the morning, right around that time as the sun was coming up, I kind of was just overcome with this feeling. It wasn't like a voice. It wasn't like, you know, somebody speaking to me. It was just more like that, you know, I started to really feel that I was powerless and I really wasn't in charge of all this stuff, and that maybe I had done some of this stuff. And, you know, I had told my sponsor, you know, I said, I've always believed in God. I just don't think he believes in me, you know, poor me, suck my thumb. And he said, well, why would he? you know, look at how you've been acting. You know, why don't you do something, give him something to believe in, and maybe he'll believe in you. Click. See all you guys I sponsor, you think I'm a hard ass, and you're hearing all this stuff. So I was just doing everything I was told to do. And at about 60 days, I started to feel a little better, you know. A lot of the times I was just miserable inside. I was coming to the realization I had done all this stuff. And you'd see me at meetings and it looked good. I'd be up there setting up chairs and passing out chips and doing the donuts. But I'm thinking under my breath, yeah, she's going to come in here and eat two damn dozen of those donuts. I know she is. And, you know, what was going on in my head didn't mirror my body. You know, my body was kind of doing the right thing, but my head was still kind of squirreling. But I'd have an hour or two where I'd feel good. I'd be relaxed and calm and serene. So in 90 days, I had to go face the first warrant. And I was kind of doing my step work with my sponsor, and I was doing this. I know nobody else does this, but I was kind of dodging the fourth step. No, you guys don't do that. And my sponsor told me, he said, if you just pray for the time and the will to get it done, you'll get it done. It'll be okay. Okay, cool, I can do that. So at 90 days, I went to face the first warrant. I went taking my 90-day chip to the probation officer. I'm thinking, he's going to hug me on the neck and pat me and tell me good like all these other guys have been doing and tell me, don't worry about this. You go on back to Atlanta and keep doing all this stuff. Man, I whipped out the chip and he looked at it and said, well, have you been playing poker? You know, he was not impressed. And he knew I was coming. He had two sheriff's deputies there, and they drug me away for 45 days. I had to make that amends to society. You know, I had driven my truck through my neighbor's fence while intoxicated and already on a suspended license with some other entanglements. And, but the thing was, the second day I was in there, it was 30, 40 guys in the pod. It was down way south of Atlanta, just a little hick country jail. This guy comes by with one of those little net bags and he says, hey man, I got a few books here if you want to read, take a look. And 6-9 books in there, something like that. And one of them was a big book. You know, that was one of the few that he had in that jail. So I took the big book and I did my four step sitting there in the Meriwether County Jail. I walked out of it 45 days later with a huge pocket full of papers. And I felt better. I got back and immediately dove in on my amends. And I kind of say this too, just kind of more out of a sense of shame than anything. I only have one white chip. And you guys that are in here young and you're trying and you're working on it, man, you're a lot smarter than me. Because I absolutely, positively would not consider this until all other options were gone. I've had people for years telling me you need to go to AA, you know, but you didn't want to really tell me twice. You know, find a new job, find a new wife, whatever. My one white chip in financial amends and everything else cost me more than my University of Georgia education did. I wrote checks for more my first 9 months sober than I graduated student loan debt with in 1987. You know, that's what my one white chip cost me. And at 6 months, when I finally cleared away the legal entanglements, I was facing a year in Cobb County, by the way. And my lawyer got a real pro 12-step judge, and rehab went with me and took a letter and all that stuff. And because of what I'd done in the previous 6 months, the judge cut my year down to 2 weeks, and I only did like 10 days. And that's a direct result of having gotten in recovery and kind of changed the way my life was going. At that point, the guy that ran the rehab offered me a job. You know, why don't you live here, work here, keep an eye on everybody. We'll send you to a bunch of training. We'll, you know, work out some stuff. It was helpful for me to be able to do my amends. And I got to go through a whole lot of training while I was there. And I got to, a lot of times, I was the only staff guy there with 25, 30 newly recovering alcoholics. And, you know, to be trusted with that level of responsibility compared to where I was before. That was pretty amazing. One of the trainings I went to, this just kind of sticks in my mind, there was a doctor, his name was Philip Flores, and he had written this big, thick book about addiction is an attachment disorder. Alcoholism, addiction, you know, is an attachment disorder. It comes from childhood trauma. Because of childhood trauma, a lot of times people can't form good, healthy relationships, and that's part of the whole addiction cycle. But his whole postulate was that the 12-step programs and worked effectively were very helpful in overcoming that type stuff, because it taught you to have helpful, you know, respectful, two-way relationships, relationships with boundaries, you know, normal adult relationships, because I just didn't do those. When I first got sober, it was either, what am I going to get out of you, or, you know, what are you going to get out of me so I can get something out of you later type stuff. And that was just real interesting that the 12-step thing was working like that. And I saw evidence of it. Another big thing, at 14 months, I went to my first rock concert. A friend of mine was playing at it. It was down at the Sweetwater 420 Festival, Candler Park. No need to do something halfway. If you're going to go have a good time. I talked to my sponsor about it. I had a plan. I went with some other people who were sober. And we just said, if we start feeling squirrely, we'll leave. We're just going to go around and have a good time and see what it's like. And, man, the feeling, the energy, you know, from the stage to the crowd and back and forth, it was 10 times better than anything I had ever been around, you know, drunk or high. The energy and everything was just so much more pure. I just had a fabulous time. And my now sponsor, wasn't my sponsor then, but it was in my network, he said, well, what can you take from that? You know, what can you learn from that? And I thought about it for a minute. I said, well, what about do the work, have no fear? You know, if you do the stuff and just keep doing the stuff, maybe you don't have to be afraid. You know, maybe you can live if you just keep doing it. Now, at 14 months, I was starting to sponsor guys some, you know, was helping guys out a lot at the rehab. At 2 years, I left the rehab, got my own place over in Dunwoody, still have the same place now. I had back surgery at a little over 3 years. Some of you guys have seen it. I got this computer in my back. It's about that big around. It's really like the $6 million man. It's a computer and battery pack, and there are a couple of electrodes sewn in on my spinal cord to kind of short-circuit the whole pain response, and it charges and programs through my skin. So it's a pretty slick thing. But that was a pretty major surgery. I was a little worried. I went in, you know, my first method of surgery. I said, look, man, I'm an alcoholic addict. You know, I'm 3 years in recovery, but this, you know. He's like, fine, man, we'll handle it. Don't even worry about it. We'll take care of you. And he did. You know, I stayed in the hospital overnight, and when I left, based on, this is an important point, based on what I had heard in my sober network from other people who had had surgeries and gone through the whole thing, I came up with a solution. I had one guy that had gone through, he'd had a car crash and messed his elbow up and folded it up underneath him one night when he was asleep, and woke up at 1:45 just in agony. And he'd taken his last dose at 10 o'clock. And he said, I waited till 2 o'clock to take that next dose because it said once every 4 hours. And he had his wife holding the pills for him. So that's what I did. I had my sponsor and another guy, you know, grab a little stuff when I left, put it in my med tray. I took it exactly as prescribed, and it ended up, I threw away the last dozen or so. I just didn't need them, you know. I was okay. Just, you know, back on the other non-narcotic stuff. It didn't bother me. I didn't think about it. I didn't obsess on it. I just kind of got back into doing what I'd already been doing. Some of you guys know, probably, some of you guys have met me in Peachford Hospital. I won't ask you to identify yourself. We call us the Shoelace Mob, the No Shoelace Mob. At 2 years, I was given an opportunity to go into Peachford Hospital. They gave me a key to Peachford, you know. I tell everybody I'm a dope fiend with a key. I get to go into Peachford and sit down with a group of folks two or three times a week on the unit and talk about solution. You know, talk about, I was here. I was just like you. You know, now this is the way I am. This is what I did. And I get to do that two or three times a week. And, man, I'm telling you, it's straight out of the big book. I walk out of Peachford, I am amazingly uplifted. I walk out of, if I have a show to do Friday night, I go to Peachford before I go do that show. When I had the back surgery, I didn't go to meetings for a few weeks. You know, wasn't that big of a deal. I had people coming to see me. But I went to Peachford when I had 30 staples in my back. You know, a week after the surgery, he says, okay, you're off the stuff. You can drive. I got in my car and drove over to Peachford and sat down with those folks again. Because that's really what does it. You know, it's no real coincidence. You know, when you go through the big book, there's one chapter that's devoted to just the first part of step 12, working with others. You know, and it says, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. It doesn't say we saved anybody. It doesn't say we successfully carried it. It just says that we try. And from all that I've been able to see, if I just try and do my best to pass it along, I get the benefit from that. I tell folks, I may not be the best sponsor. I have no expectations of my sponsees. I tell them what I did. I tell them, you know, the more you call me, the more solution you'll get, the better you'll feel, all that kind of stuff. But they're either going to do it or they won't. That's kind of between them and God. I'm just kind of trying to make the introduction. On the whole God thing, step 11, you know, man, I put on my God every morning before I put on my pants. I have the pants beside the bed, you know, when I'm out of the bed on my knees in my boxers, you know, talking to God and getting ready for the day before I start going. I prayed tonight before I got in here. You know, I pray before I go into Peachford. It just seems to have made such a profound difference. Step 10, this is kind of a funny step 10 story, and then I'll hush. When I was working at the rehab, there was a guy that worked there. I don't guess it's really breaking his anonymity because he worked there. His name is Chauncey. Some of you guys know him. And once I started working there, I worked during the week, and I was off on the weekend. So I kind of like to sleep on the weekends. And some of you folks that have been around me, you know it's not a wise thing to wake me up. And I'm just not real happy when I first wake up. And he would come and wake the whole house up, and he would he'd make a lot of noise. He'd wake me up. I had the master suite, but he'd still wake me up and make a bunch of noise. And when I first got there and started doing that, I would chase him down the steps. You know, I'd throw stuff at him. I'd just, you know, come up here. And after a few months, I kind of quit doing that. I'm like, well, you know, it's not that big of a deal. And then I'd still kind of, you know, have some words with him. I went and made step 10 amends to him, probably for about 6 weeks in a row there. I went, you know, sometime between 10 and 11 in the morning, and I'd say, Chauncey, I'm sorry I said that about your mom. You know, I really didn't mean it. And after that, I kind of didn't have to do it anymore. And the point is, he never changed at all. I changed just kind of through doing the stuff in this program. My acceptance and tolerance and understanding kind of grew to the point I knew he was just kind of doing what he did. He was doing his job, and there was no need to get bent out of shape, and I just let it roll off my back and went back to sleep. You know? But anyway, that's about it. I really thank you guys for having me. It's an excellent 5 years, no doubt.
Wow, Mike, thank you for that. I told you guys, he does the deal. He really does. And he, see what that kind of deal gives you. Strong, strong program and a strong message.
Hey, family, my name is Alonzo, and the evidence is very, very, very clear that I'm an alcoholic. It gives me great pleasure. This man, Mike, asked me to sponsor him a few years ago. He had already done the deal. We had a book study at his country club called Breakthrough, and that's how we kind of got together, and we worked through the book yet again. At some point, the line between sponsor and sponsee can be a little hazy. Who's sponsoring who? Right? Who showing who what? And that's how Mike and I are. Mike,
like me here.
Mike, okay, really?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Mike has been there for me during a very difficult time in my sobriety. Just because I have a few 24 hours doesn't mean I always get it. And I'm very proud of him and the work he does. And I find it most ironic that they gave him a key at Peachford. Right? That's what he does. And anybody here wants what you heard him talk about, come see Mike after the meeting.
Again, everybody, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. This is Five. Really, you've heard probably about all you need to hear out of me tonight. I have a memory just popped into my head that I wanted to share during my story, but I didn't. The first week that I met Alonzo, he was doing the book study, and there was an old guy in the book study that he remembers. He knows what I'm talking about. And the guy was an Alabama fan, and he was really kind of obnoxious, you know, to me being a Georgia fan and, you know, an ex-Georgia player and all that stuff. He was kind of giving me a hard time. He's probably 70 years old, but, you know, decent-sized guy. And after the book study, he squared up on me like, come on, you know. Yeah, I was fresh and raw and everything. I came in and hit him. I didn't hit him nearly as hard as I could, but it knocked him through the air, and he hit the wall about 3 feet away and slid down the wall and literally pooped his pants. And Alonzo's running around going, wait, we got a form. I got a form I got to fill out. I think I got a check box. I said, man, you got a check box for somebody pooping their pants? What the hell kind of place is this? You know, and that was kind of how it started. But anyway, thanks, everybody.
Do you have any other birthdays? All right, thank God for the chips you hold.
I think we should have given Mike another 30 minutes, because we got some good stuff. Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
I'm coming.